Molloy, Iowa. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Vetäwe and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ يُنْفِقُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سَبْعَ سَنَابِلَ كَمَثَلِ حَبَّةٍ أَنْبَتَتْ سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's foreign minister says it is possible to achieve a final agreement in the sanctions removal talks in Doha if the U.S. and its European allies act realistically. Britain's criminal lawyers stage a walkout over low wages and insufficient government funding amid the country's dire economic crisis and soaring cost of living. Also, Kiev says 16 people have been killed and dozens injured in a Russian missile attack on a mall in central Ukraine. Good to have you with us. Iran's top negotiator will set off for the Qatari capital on Tuesday to hold indirect talks with the U.S. on the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. That's according to the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman. Nasser Kanani says the trip is made within the framework of agreements reached during the recent visit to Tehran by the JCPOA Joint Commission Coordinator Joseph Borrell. Iran says it was informed by Borrell that the U.S. has agreed to fulfill all its obligations under the JCPOA and ensure Iran's economic benefits. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian also says the new round of talks could yield a final agreement if the U.S. and the three EU parties to the deal adopt a realistic approach. The 2015 deal was left in tatters after the former U.S. administration unilaterally abandoned it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Talks to revive the JCPOA began in the Austrian capital in April last year between Iran and the remaining signatories to the accord. The U.S. indirectly participated in the Vienna talks. After several rounds, the talks were stalled in March this year over what Iran called the U.S. failure to make the necessary decisions. Iran's top military commander warns that Israel's integration into the U.S. military's central command and the regime's participation in its military drills is a threat to the region. Major General Mohammad Bogheri says Iran will not tolerate such threats and will certainly respond. The chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces stressed that the Israeli regime is the mastermind of all interventionist and destabilizing plots in the region. He added that Israel is hatching schemes to create links with regional countries and achieve its meddlesome goals. CENTCOM, which has declared countering Iran as one of its priorities, assumed command responsibility for the U.S. military's relationship with Israel last September. A CENTCOM delegation met Israeli army officials last week discussing ways to strengthen cooperation. Israel and the U.S. also recently conducted a joint war game in northern Israel. Iran says Greece has released an Iranian-flagged oil tanker that it seized 2 months ago under U.S. pressure. According to the Ports and Maritime Organization, the tanker is set to load the oil cargo, which had been illegally transferred to a U.S. chartered vessel. Earlier this month, a court in Greece ruled that the cargo must be returned to its owner, overturning an earlier ruling that allowed the U.S. confiscation of part of the shipment. At the time, Iran described the seizure of the oil cargo as an act of piracy and in violation of international law. Greek authorities claimed they seized the ship due to European Union sanctions. An official Iranian delegation representing the media sector in Iran has paid a two-day visit to Syria, headed by Chief of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, Peyman Jibeli. Our correspondent in Damascus has the details in this report.
An official Iranian delegation headed by Chief of the IRIB, Peyman Jibeli, arrived in Damascus and met with Syria's Prime Minister Hossein Arnous, who called for expansion of ties with Iranian media outlets for unmasking false media campaigns that some countries launched to mislead the public opinion on the truth of events in West Asia. Jibeli, who also had a separate meeting with Minister of Information Boutros Halaq, said economic pressure on Syria is a result of Syria's triumph on terror and the defeat of enemies, stressing the importance of strong cooperation in confronting the media war against the two states.
Our meetings with Syrian officials will open a new and wide page in cultural and media cooperation. Due to Syria's resistance and its allies, the war on Syria failed in its objectives. We should document this victory in the mind of the Arab and world public opinion, and this requires a high level of cooperation with Syria in the media sector. This is what we agreed on today.
Coordination among media sectors is highly important. We as a resistance alliance are facing media empires which no state can face alone. We should face pressures, sanctions, and false campaigns. So we all should combine efforts in Iran, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Palestine.
Meanwhile, the delegation participated in a seminar held in rejection of normalization of relations with Israel. Jibeli said the reason behind pressures on the peoples of the region is the failure of enemies' conspiracies, asserting there is no future for normalization with Israel.
The normalization of relations with Israel that we witnessed recently by some states in the region is almost coming to an end because the people do not accept it. Normalization has no future because it is against the principles of humanity. Normalization with the killer of children and journalists is not logical. We will defeat the enemy in the media just like we fought the conspiracies, and that is only if we are united.
The delegation is scheduled to hold more meetings on Tuesday and sign agreements with Syrian media outlets. The visit aims to further boost cooperation between the media sectors of both countries to reach the level of strategic relations between Syria and Iran and strongly counter the media war waged against member countries of the Resistance Alliance. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
The World Food Program says it is suspending humanitarian aid to Yemen. The international body says it's halting the shipments due to lack of funding and disruptions in food supplies rooted in the war in Ukraine. Abdulatif Al-Washili brings us the details from Sana'a.
After years of war and blockade on Yemen, and just as hopes were being raised that the humanitarian situation will improve thanks to the UN brokered truce, the World Food Programme has announced that it is suspending humanitarian work in the country since the beginning of June. The body says it is short on funding and that obstacles to food supply due to war in Ukraine are making things worse.
There is no doubt that the decision of the World Food Programme to suspend its activities in Yemen is catastrophic and surprising. The World Food Programme announced earlier this year that it will be cutting off on humanitarian aid for Yemen due to lack of funding. The suspension of humanitarian activities is a totally different story and has major repercussions, as Yemen is facing what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Unfortunately, the UN and its food assistance programme link humanitarian aid to political and military issues.
The program now says that the Yemen humanitarian response plan for 2022 is 74% underfunded, which means the program requires $1.5 billion in funding.
What the media reported that the World Food Program will suspend its activities in Yemen will lead to a humanitarian catastrophe with unimaginable consequences. We hold the United Nations fully responsible for the repercussions of halting humanitarian aid, as Yemen is in a phase of famine.
Saudi Arabia began its war on Yemen in March 2015 and has imposed a siege on the country ever since. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine, where almost 80% of the population depends on humanitarian aid to survive.
After all the hard work put into reaching the Karen truce and extending it, suspension of humanitarian aid could also undermine the political process. The United Nations should now double its efforts and change its strategies to help Yemenis in dire need of aid. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
In the UK, strikes over low wages have spread to the legal profession. British criminal lawyers have staged a walkout in London to protest against government funding and dwindling earnings. According to the Criminal Bar Association, barristers voted for industrial action earlier this month. More than 80% of its members backed walkouts. On Monday, several hundred barristers gathered outside the Central Criminal Court. They have refused to take on new cases or cover cases for colleagues, which have overrun. Protesting lawmakers say their real earnings have dropped around 30% since 2006. They also say many junior barristers have left their jobs due to low income. The Criminal Bar Association has urged the government to sit down with barristers for negotiation.
This must come to an end, and it will, if this government is prepared to sit down with us and negotiate. We cannot continue to work like this.
The CBA also said the walkout is aimed at preventing the collapse of the criminal justice system, which is already mired in crisis. It said the justice system has long been suffering from a shortage of lawyers. The British government has reacted to the strike, saying the walkouts are regrettable. The lawyers' strike comes hot on the heels of an industrial action by some 40,000 British railway workers. Moving on to the ongoing war between Russia and Ukraine, which is now in its fifth month. Kiev says 16 people are killed in a new Russian missile attack on the central Ukrainian city of Kremenchuk. Local authorities say the strike hit a crowded shopping mall. Nearly 60 people were also injured. Ukraine's capital Kiev was also hit by Russian missiles for the first time in 3 weeks. Ukrainian authorities say the attack killed one person and wounded six others. A fierce battle is also raging on in the eastern Donbass region, according to media reports. Russian troops are advancing into Lysychansk, the last major city still in the hands of Ukrainian forces in the Luhansk region. Ukraine says Russia is also bombing the city. That comes just days after the Russian army took over the neighboring city of Severodonetsk after weeks of siege. Staying with Ukraine, the U.S. says it's going to send the country sophisticated anti-aircraft missiles to help it defend against Russian attacks. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan says his country is in the process of finalizing a weapons package for Ukraine. He says the package includes advanced medium and long-range air defense systems, as well as items that are of urgent need. Last week, the U.S. said it's sending a new batch of military assistance to Ukraine worth $450 million. That pushes the U.S. aid to Ukraine to over $6 billion. Russia has already warned of serious consequences over the West's military support for Ukraine. Civilians, including women and children, are withstanding the worst effects of the conflict in Ukraine. Jenny Miller has attended a funeral ceremony for a six-year-old girl who was killed by the Ukrainian army's shelling in the eastern Donbass region.
A six-year-old girl lies in her coffin. Her name is Alina. She was killed by Ukrainian army shelling of the Donetsk region. Her family and the local community mourn together. As she's taken away to the burial site, her grandmother bids farewell to her beloved granddaughter for the last time. She asks for forgiveness. Now, Alina was killed in the playground. Speaking to locals and the family, they tell me that she was killed because of a Ukrainian shell that was fired and an anti-air defense missile fired by the Russians hit that missile in the mid-air and shrapnel showered to the ground to kill Alina. A few moments ago, there was the massive boom of the anti-air defense working. Alina didn't die straight away. She was taken to hospital and died 2 days later. The clock is stopped at 6:12, the moment Alina's heart stopped beating. She arrives at the burial site. Her family say their final goodbyes.
Now, there's something particularly shocking about a child killed in war. Few people here can hold back the tears. While millions of people in NATO countries continue to encourage their governments to send more weapons to Ukraine instead of negotiating for peace, the fact of the matter is, The longer this war goes on, the more children like Alina will be killed.
A memorial in Donetsk. The sign reads, "To the children killed in Donbass since 2014. There is no end date, as children continue to die." Alina's whole life was lived during this war, a war now escalated by the Russian invasion and NATO's policy of arming Ukraine instead of pushing for negotiations. This is the true reality of war. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
A remote area in Texas, an abandoned truck, and stacks of dead bodies. That's the grim picture from one of the deadliest cases of human smuggling along the U.S.-Mexico border. U.S. authorities have found the bodies of 46 undocumented migrants in a semi-trailer near the rail track in San Antonio. 16 people, including four minors, were still alive. They are currently being treated for heat stroke and exhaustion. So far, three people are in police custody. The U.S. border with Mexico has seen an influx of migrants over the past months. Many of them are returned under a controversial policy that former President Donald Trump introduced. Incumbent Joe Biden has faced a lot of criticism from fellow Democrats for failing to reverse the restrictions, but Republicans blast his open border policy. A rail travel from Los Angeles to Chicago turns into a nightmare for passengers after their train collides with a truck on its route. Seven of the eight wagons were derailed and toppled on their sides as the long-haul train was crossing through rural Missouri. There have been three deaths and multiple injuries. The train was carrying more than 200 passengers and around a dozen crew. Officials say the train was crossing a gravel road that had neither lights nor electronic control devices for the trucks. The National Transportation Safety Board says a 14-member team will investigate the derailment. Just one day before this incident, another train struck a passenger car at a crossing in California, leaving three people dead. Ecuador's President Guillermo Lasso announces a cut in fuel prices following 2 weeks of anti-government protests over soaring food and energy prices.
I decided to reduce the price of gasoline and ecopice to 10 cents per gallon and diesel also to 10 cents per gallon.
In a live address, Lasso also said that Ecuadorians who seek dialogue will find an outstretched hand from the government. He warned, however, that those who seek chaos, violence, and terrorism will find the full force of the law. The announcement comes a day after authorities lifted a state of emergency that had been imposed in six provinces in the wake of violent protests. Earlier, the country's energy ministry said that crude output is at a critical level and could be halted entirely within 48 hours if protests and roadblocks continued. The demonstrations by largely indigenous groups began on June 13th and have led to at least six civilian deaths. The protesters were demanding lower fuel and food prices, among other things. And with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
In the Limelight.
Through its agencies, the U.S. government regularly plants fake news and false information. Therefore, social media hiring individuals straight from the FBI, CIA, NATO, and other groups to work on regulating disinformation is a fundamentally flawed practice. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Alan McLeod, journalist. This article is published under the heading, The Federal Bureau of Tweets. Twitter is hiring an alarming number of FBI agents. Stay tuned, please, for the second part of this article. Some might ask, what is the problem with Twitter actively recruiting from the FBI, CIA, and other three-letter agencies? They, after all, are experts in studying online disinformation and propaganda. What is optical? If a Russian-owned social media apps trust, security and content moderation was run by former KGB or FSB agents and still insisted it was a politically neutral platform, the entire world would laugh. But apart from this, the huge influx of security state personnel into Twitter's decision-making ranks means that the company will start to view every problem in the same manner as the US government does and act accordingly. In terms of their outlooks on the world and on the question of misinformation and internet security, you couldn't get a better field of professionals who are almost inherently going to be more in tune with the government's perspective. Thus, when policing the platform for disinformation and influence campaigns, the former FBI and CIA agents and Atlantic Council fellows only ever seem to find them emanating from enemy states and never from the US regime itself. Twitter has mirrored US hostility towards states like Russia, China, and Cuba, attempting to suppress the reach and influence of their state media by adding warning messages to the tweets of journalists and accounts affiliated with those governments. In a rather bizarre adamant, it explained that it would not be doing the same to state-affiliated media or personalities from other countries, least of all the US state-financed media organizations with editorial independence, like NPR, for example, are not defined as a state-affiliated media for the purposes of this policy, it wrote. Perhaps most notable, however, was Twitter's announcement last year that it was deleting dozens of accounts for the new violation of undermining faith in the NATO alliance. The statement was widely ridiculed online by users, but few noted that the decision was based upon a partnership with the Stanford Internet Observatory, a counter-disinformation think tank filled with former spooks and state officials and headed by an individual who is on the advisory board of NATO's Collective Cybersecurity Center of Excellence. That Twitter is working so closely with organizations that are clearly intelligence industry catspaws should concern all users. While some might be alarmed that Twitter is cultivating such an intimate relationship with the FBI and other groups belonging to the secret state, it is perhaps unfair to single it out, as many social media platforms are doing the same. Facebook, for example, has entered into formal partnership with the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensics Research Lab, whereby the latter holds significant influence over 2.9 billion users' news feeds, helping to decide what content to promote and what content to suppress. The NATO cutout organization now serves as Facebook's eyes and ears, according to a Facebook press release. Anti-war and anti-establishment voices across the world have reported massive drops in traffic on the platform. The social media giant also hired former NATO press secretary Ben Nemo to be its head of intelligence. Nemo subsequently used his power to attempt to swing the election in Nicaragua away from the leftist Sandinista party and towards the far-right pro-US candidate, deleting hundreds of left-wing voices in the week of the election, claiming they were engaging in inauthentic behavior. When these individuals, including some well-known personalities, poured onto Twitter, recording video messages proving they were not bots, Twitter deleted those accounts too, in what one commentator called a Silicon Valley double tap strike. An April Mint Press study revealed how TikTok, too, has been filling its organization with alumni of the Atlantic Council, NATO, the CIA, and the State Department. As with Twitter, these new TikTok employees largely work in highly politically sensitive fields such as trust, safety, security, and content moderation, meaning these state operatives hold influence over the direction of the company and what content is promoted and what is demoted. In corporate media, too, we have seen a widespread infiltration of former security officials into the upper echelons of news organizations. So normalized is the penetration of the national security state into the media that is supposed to be holding it into account that few reacted in 2015 when Dawn Eskenazi left her job as National Intelligence Manager for the Western Hemisphere at the Director of National Intelligence to become the Global Business Director of International News Conglomerate Thomson Reuters. Eskenazi, a 33-year CIA veteran who had worked her way up to become a director in the organization, was open about what her role was. In a blog post on the Reuters website, she wrote that she was there to meet the desperate needs of the U.S. government, a statement that is at odds with even the most basic journalistic concepts of impartiality and holding the powerful to account. Meanwhile, cable news outlets routinely employ a wide range of former agents and mandarins as trusted personalities and experts. These include former CIA directors John Brennan and Michael Hayden, ex-director of National Intelligence James Clapper, and former Homeland Security Advisor Francis Townsend. And news for so many Americans comes delivered through ex-CIA interns like Anderson Cooper, CIA applicants like Tucker Carlson, or by Mika Brzezinski, the daughter of a powerful National Security Advisor. The FBI has its own former agents on TV as well, with talking heads such as James Gagliano, Asha Rakpa, and Frank Figoluski becoming household names. In short, then, the national security state once used to infiltrate the media. Today, however, the national security state is the media. Social media holds enormous influence in today's society. While this article is not alleging that anyone mentioned is a bad actor or does not genuinely care about the spread of disinformation, it is highlighting a glaring conflict of interest. Through its agencies, the U.S. government regularly plants fake news and false information. Therefore, social media hiring individuals straight from the FBI, CIA, NATO, and other groups to work on regulating disinformation is a fundamentally flawed practice. One of media's primary functions is to serve as a fourth estate, a force that works to hold the government and its agencies to account. Yet instead of doing that, increasingly it is collaborating with them. Such are these increasing interlocking connections that it is becoming increasingly difficult to see where big government ends and big media begins.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. This show brings reports from all over the world on Zionist efforts to stamp out criticism of its occupation of Palestine. Today, we look at the murky activities of a little-known tech company called Proofpoint. As a result of acquiring several Israeli companies, Proofpoint appears to have a suspiciously close relationship with the Zionist regime. Later in the show, we'll look at how this company has involved itself in propaganda, which includes attacks on Palestinians and their supporters. But first, we've got this special report by Bianca Rahimi explaining how Proofpoint transformed from a US tech company into a vehicle for ex-Israeli intelligence operatives.
Is Israel using cybersecurity company Proofpoint to spy on key U.S. media companies? The U.S. company, which filters the emails of journalists at The Washington Post and CNN, has subsumed three different companies, which were set up by alumni at the Israeli military's infamous Unit 8200 intelligence department that surveils Palestinian electronic communication. It also appears that the company has provided email filtering services for SOAS University, University College London, and other British and US educational institutions. The cybersecurity firm currently has four floors containing 200 employees in the Azraeli Center, directly next door to the Israeli Ministries of Defense and Intelligence in the temporary entity. Are these employees, many of whom worked in key jobs in the Israeli regime, filtering the emails of students, academics, and journalists in the US and the UK? If so, can that information be considered safe? The first company was FireLayers, an Israeli startup fully funded by seed fund investor YL Ventures, which has the key aim of funding Israeli military personnel in starting tech companies. FireLayers was founded by Yair Greinlinger and Doron Algrassi, both veterans of Israel's tech unit. When he was asked if his time in the military contributed to his work with FireLayers, Greinlinger responded, "It has been a while since then, and I am still in the game." FireLayers attended a special invite-only conference funded by the Israeli Ministry of Intelligence just a year before it was subsumed into Proofpoint. The second company of suspicion which Proofpoint has subsumed is Meta Networks. It was founded by Alon Horowitz, a former officer in the Israeli military's engineering corps, a highly sensitive position which he says required taking a polygraph test every couple of years. Meta Networks also employed many other key figures from Israeli military and intelligence bodies. The third troubling company which has been subsumed by Proofpoint is Observit. The startup, founded by Gabi Friedlander and Avi Amos, has a research and development center in Tel Aviv. It also employs staff from the Israeli military and intelligence. The revolving door also runs in the opposite direction. Yuri Chotzen went from working for Observe It for a year to being employed by Israeli intelligence for 3 years. The absorption of these companies has led to an influx of former Israeli military personnel into Proofpoint. However, military is not the only background. Proofpoint's current senior HR business partner is Noam Korotkisalov, who was previously employed for 6 years doing an undisclosed job at the Israeli Prime Minister's office.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller, who joins us today via Skype from Bristol. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of a lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. I'm pleased to say that we're also joined in the studio today by Loki. Loki is a British-Iraqi rapper and a political activist. He's a patron of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and he's been very active in demanding justice and accountability for the victims and survivors of the Grenfell disaster. Welcome to the show. Loki, let me start with you. And you were one of the first, weren't you, to expose a Proofpoint in a recently published investigation. So we've got mainstream journalists who are apparently having their emails filtered by this company. I mean, journalists at mainstream media outlets. I mean, can you just tell our viewers what the significance of that is?
Well, firstly, it's important to establish that Proofpoint subsumed three different organizations that have a revolving door relationship with Israeli military and intelligence institutions. They are Firelayers, Meta Networks, and Observe It. Now, off the back of that, Proofpoint has not only opened an office in the Azraeli Center, which is next door to the Israeli Ministries of Intelligence and Defense, but also in addition to that, Proofpoint has been involved in a push to really discredit and target not only Palestinian resistance, but also Iran with allegations of hacking. Prior to the acquisition by Proofpoint of these three companies, you did not see Proofpoint publishing reports of this nature. But overall, this is symptomatic of a policy that, according to an article in Calculus Tech, which has states clearly that it passed the Israeli military censor. This was a policy from 2012 of the Netanyahu regime to move employees from Israeli military intelligence into private companies, and in fact use private companies to function like Israeli intelligence. So we get to a point where we cannot tell where Israeli intelligence begins and private companies end, and vice versa. So it's really a manifestation of a very, very important policy which we need to cultivate a criticality around.
Yeah. I mean, David, it also appears that the companies are filtering emails at UK universities. I mean, do you see that as a problem?
Well, this is a very, very strange story, isn't it? This is a tech company which apparently gives, you know, some kind of neutral technological service to universities, media institutions. And yet it has these strange connections with Israeli intelligence and military personnel or ex-personnel. I mean, one of the things which raises an issue here is that, you know, where is this data going? What are they doing with it? How are they using data which they've got access to? And is it safe? Is it data which they're keeping simply for business purposes? Or is any of this leaching out to the Israeli intelligence services? That's the question I would ask.
I mean, Loki, now that Proofpoint's acquired these companies, can you explain what the connection is with the Israeli military and intelligence, and why that's problematic? I mean, you did say that they're kind of located right next door. I mean, just tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, specifically, when we look at an organization like Firelayers, Firelayers was started by two veterans of the Israeli tech unit in the Israeli military. But also just a year before Firelayers was acquired by Proofpoint, Fire Layers attended an invitation-only conference from the Institute for National Security Studies, which is led by former Israeli intelligence figures. And the conference itself was actually funded by several Israeli government ministries, including the Ministry of Intelligence. It was described as a synergetic hub through which ties could be built between private and public companies, between Israel and the United States. In addition to that, you have Meta Networks, which was founded by Alan Horowitz, who, as was said in the report, had such a high-ranking position within the Israeli military that he had to take a polygraph test every few years. So what's clear is that these organizations, and the important point to make here, is that their employees became employees of Proofpoint. There's not an arm's-length relationship between Proofpoint and these companies. They were subsumed fully into Proofpoint. So when Proofpoint delivers email filtering services to an outlet like the Washington Post or CNN, who, by the way, both of them have recently published work around the killing of Shirin Abu Akleh, for example, CNN, concluding late though it was, that it's most likely that the Israeli military killed Shirin Abu Akleh. When those emails are going back and forth, who is having access to them? That is the key question here.
No, indeed. And David, I mean, we regularly discuss the Israel occupation forces and the intelligence services on this show, don't we? And I get the feeling that these are much more active in society than we might have imagined. I mean, is that true?
Well, I think that myself has been really shocked when I come across Western intelligence agencies active in some nefarious doings. But the fact that they are involved in even apparently neutral tech companies is quite stunning, really, isn't it? I mean, there seems to be Israeli intelligence, and indeed the intelligence agencies of other Western countries, the US, the UK and others, involved in very, very many areas of life which you wouldn't think were the activities of intelligence agencies, in companies, in private companies, in civil society groups and charities. And it's really much more extensive as an area of activity than perhaps we think of. Maybe we have seen James Bond films when we were younger, or we've read the stuff about the intelligence services, the history of the CIA or MI6 and MI5 and Mossad. But the expansion of the intelligence agencies into almost all areas of life, I think, is something really quite remarkable, and seems to have been accomplished much more intensively in the last decade or so.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, Loki, that the Israeli government, you know, seems to be, as it were, arm's lengthing, you know, privatizing almost their sort of intelligence operations. If you know what you're saying about these companies is correct. I mean, what's going on? I mean, is this to sort of, as it were, avoid, blame, responsibility, culpability for some of the nefarious activities that these organisations are getting up to on their behalf?
So it's been specific policy since 2012. You've had the founding in what they call Beersheba, a cyber tech unit which exists directly alongside Unit 8200. It's important for us to clarify what Unit 8200 is. It's the signals intelligence unit in the IDF, founded in the 50s, over 1,500 members of it. But what it focuses on doing is surveilling the electronic communication of Palestinians. It's been referred to as Israel's big brother. There have been whistleblowers within it and alumni of it that have come out and signed a letter saying what they are doing is using information to blackmail Palestinians into collaboration. It's sort of an omnipotent surveillance entity which is formed around the occupation, and it buttresses that physical seizing of the land. It's the seizing of information. And so this is the unit from which so much of this comes. And I'm sure we'll get into in a moment some of the other organizations that have serious question marks around them, especially when you take into account the history of Israeli spying on the United States specifically.
I mean, just finally, before we go to the next VT, it was interesting, wasn't it? I think it was last year that the Labour Party, Sir Keir Starmer, appointed a former 8200 operative to head up the Labour Party's social media activities. I don't know if you've got any thoughts about that.
Precisely, and Asaf Kaplan's supposed function within the Labour Party is social listening. Now, in the context of Labour functioning as an internal surveillance system, which disqualifies people from political subjectivity in this country, what is the significance of us having somebody directly coming from Unit 8200 and being there to essentially police the social media profiles of possible members of the party and others?
Indeed. Interesting question. But we'll pause there for a moment because I want to just have a look at this report on how Proofpoints got involved in using its access to client data to engage in propaganda against Palestinians.
Prior to subsuming these three Israeli startups, US company Proofpoint had no history of spotting hacks allegedly linked to the Islamic Republic of Iran or the Palestinian resistance. But since the acquisitions, the company has taken a special interest in this subject.
Iran has been of special interest because of the tensions in the Middle East that have risen over the past several months. When Proofpoint talks about APT actors, what we mean is advanced persistent threat actors. State-sponsored APT actors typically have the backing and financial resources of a nation state, meaning they have access to the most advanced tools. What's really important for organizations to understand about Iranian APT threat groups is that they are incredibly sophisticated and they have a long history of attacking targets in the United States and in their own backyard in the Middle East. The Iranian actors that we track have lots of specific trademarks that allow us to attribute their activity.
Proofpoint has also sought to blame the besieged people of Gaza by reporting on what it claims is Palestinian-aligned espionage. The Proofpoint report into supposed Palestinian hacking was written by former German government employee Konstantin Klinger and former FBI agent Joshua Miller, who is simultaneously a Proofpoint researcher and a reserve captain in the U.S. military. Another Proofpoint report targeting the Islamic Republic of Iran was authored by former BAE Systems employee Michael Raggi and Krista Gehring, herself a former employee of the CIA. An additional report on supposed Palestinian hacking was co-authored by someone who went from working as a journalist for CNN to working for Proofpoint, Selena Larson. She's also a fellow of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, which features John M. Deutsch, the former director of the CIA, on its board. It seems doubtful that a company full of former Israeli spies and current reserves in the U.S. Army can be taken as a neutral authority on these matters.
David, this is all very murky, isn't it? I mean, this company acquires Israel-based firms with strong intelligence connections. Then it starts leveraging its access to client data to produce what appears to be uncheckable stories about alleged Iranian and Palestinian hacking operations. I mean, what do you make of this?
Well, it's an extraordinary part of the story. I mean, the stuff we've talked about already about its involvement with Israeli intelligence is worrying enough. But the fact that they're now leveraging the information that they're getting from clients for by whatever means to push pro-Israel propaganda stories, which have clearly very little basis in fact, is extremely worrying. I mean, this is the point. This is not just surveillance and the use of surveillance and the outsourcing of surveillance to private companies on behalf of Israeli intelligence. It's also the weaponization of that information to intimidate and to try and force individuals into particular courses of action. It's a propaganda operation, and it's much more than just surveillance as we currently think of it. It's about actually intervening in the society and trying to influence it.
Mm. I mean, I wonder, Loki, whether we could pick up on the point that you were talking about this unit 8200 and elaborate a little bit more. I mean, it's an obscure intelligence agency, isn't it? I mean, just say a little bit more about that, because people, I think, will be interested to find out.
Well, I think the key thing to understand here is that in terms of the people that do the cybersecurity for Lockheed Martin, the people that do the cybersecurity for Leidos, the people that do the cybersecurity for several Department of Defense classified databases, The companies were founded by former members of Unit 8200. Of course, the article that I mentioned in Calculus Tech, which passed through the Israeli military censor, made clear that Black Cube, for example, was set up to function in this way by former Unit 8200 people. When we look at the company that does the cybersecurity for the Lockheed Martin and Leidos stuff, it's Cyber Reason. Now, Cyber Reason, again, was set up by former Unit 8200 people. The CEO of Cyber Reason actually said in an interview in TechCrunch that his work in Cyber Reason was a continuation of his work in Unit 8200. Now, just when we take into account Lockheed Martin is key US defense contractor, it carried out the census in this country in 2010, 2011. Leidos also had involvement in the census more recently. But if we think historically from Robert Maxwell pushing the Promise software into the United States to be used essentially for Israel to spy on its nuclear development in the US. Also, we have the example of Jonathan Pollard placing a backdoor in US computer systems in order for it to be used by Israeli intelligence. When we also take into account that even the White House, Bill Clinton's phone line was tapped by Israeli intelligence in the 90s, which gave them pre-knowledge of the Monica Lewinsky scandal. What you're talking about is the number one entity which spies on the United States now having access through Cyber Reason to several very important, potentially having access to several very important classified databases. For example, with the pandemic, you saw the setting up of the Cyber Threat Intelligence League, which was founded by Ohad Zeidenberg, again, a former Unit 8200 member. Now, this gentleman simultaneously works for an organization which is funded by the Israeli regime. And also, what you have to understand about the Cyber Threat Intelligence League is it offered pro bono cybersecurity to places of importance in the United States, like nuclear plants, chemical reactors, dams, hospitals, the health service. And in many cases, it was granted that access to deliver pro bono, free of charge cybersecurity. Now, were this any other entity, were this any other intelligence organization that had this type of umbilical-like role with these companies, there is no way that you would see this level of access to information, certainly not in the United States.
No, indeed. Well, from what you're saying, it sounds kind of almost ubiquitous intelligence, Israeli intelligence operation throughout the globe. But David, let me come to you. I mean, these stories remind me a bit about the widespread claims of Russian hacking and Russian disinformation. Is there a parallel, do you think, with this?
Very much so. I mean, this whole idea that our enemies are engaged in hacking and hack and leak operations, as it's been said in the UK in recent weeks, or that they are engaged in disinformation. It's a huge disinformation industry which now exists to point out alleged Russian or Chinese disinformation. And almost all of it, practically all of it, is actually funded by Western defense and security interests. It's actually about distracting attention from the actual disinformation which is pushed out by Western governments. And it's the same with the Israelis. There are Israeli-backed disinformation monitors in this country as well. And this operation here to try and direct attention to Palestinian espionage or to the Iranians' alleged role. This is the same kind of thing. It's the same playbook that's being used in this country, for example, with the recent Masongate story, where a British journalist, left-wing journalist, Paul Mason, was engaged in the direct communications with MI6 to suggest that they should target rogue left academics who might be critical of the government's policy on Ukraine. And of course, the way in which those kinds of ideas come out about these rogue academics, these are coming directly from not Putin talking points, but MI6 talking points. We actually see now that these talking points exist, that in this case, the handler for Paul Mason, a guy called Andy Price, actually sends by email to his contacts a list of things he'd like to push out And that's all the latest stories on, for example, on Ukraine or in previous cases on Russia, Russia's alleged disinformation or Russia's actions. So much of what we see in the mainstream press, like these hacker stories from Proofpoint, is actually talking points from the intelligence services of Israel, the US and the UK.
Well, I mean, these are very troubling accusations, for sure, aren't they? And I wonder, Loki, whether you might be able to say a bit more and perhaps maybe give us some other examples of companies that are perhaps engaged in similar activities. I mean, are there other companies engaged in similar activities, that is?
Well, so, for example, we have had one of the most glaring examples recently, which has not been seized upon, unfortunately, by many of us and also the media at all. You know, the NSO group pushing this Pegasus spyware across the planet, claiming that it has no access to the information that is gleaned from these devices through the Pegasus spyware. On top of that, you have British Gas actually investing its employees' pensions into the NSO group's stuff. You had key figures in British civil society, thousands of journalists, human rights defenders across the planet having their phones hacked by Pegasus spyware. And I think the key thing to understand is that actually NSO group, rather than being distant from the Israeli government as some tried to depict it in the beginning, it's actually been revealed to be an arm of the Israeli regime. And so here we see this massive, as you say, ubiquitous network of surveillance infrastructure, which is essentially about the war over data. And I think very much so, the data war is actually bigger than the physical war on land. And so we really have to cultivate